how does someone get hooked on alcohol? For Jenny Valentish, her decades-long addiction started when she was just 13. She'd steal from her father's liquor cabinet. By the time she was 15, she was getting drunk every day after school. Jenny grew up in the UK and moved to Australia 10 years ago. She stopped drinking in 2009, and ever since she's been researching the nature of addiction, in particular, the female experience of it, and the kind of muddy terrain between self-medication and self-destruction. Jenny, welcome to Life Matters.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now tell me, was the research that you embarked on into addiction, was that also in a way part of your recovery?
Yeah, actually it did start back in, well, actually 2008, which was before I quit drinking, which was probably the wrong time to start. I started looking into what is it that makes us do things that don't really make sense. Why do we keep making the same mistakes over and over again? Why do we have this powerful drive inside us that's really hard to resist? So I started doing a bit of research on who would be the best people to talk to at that point. Pitched it to an agent, had a meeting with an agent, except I missed it because I got a bit drunk the night before. We both agreed it might be the wrong time. So the following year, after I'd quit, I started making notes, and I dashed out about 100,000 words in that first year, which were quite raw, as you might imagine. So the finished product really was 2015, starting from scratch, but using all that as a base.
Mm. Well, with alcohol and drug addiction, it's not uncommon for sexual abuse to figure in the backstory. Can you tell us about your experience?
Yeah, well, I was abused by a sort of neighbourhood boy 5 years older when I was about seven, which it wasn't discussed within the family because I didn't make it clear. So it was something I grew up with being very ashamed of and keeping a secret, which kind of creates this double life from quite a young age, which then as you grow older, substances can fill that kind of gap. You know, you have this secretive behaviour that continues as an adult where perhaps people aren't quite aware how much you're drinking, or, you know, if you're taking drugs, maybe you're taking more than you're letting on. So it really kind of set the tone for this self-loathing kind of duplicity.
And that sent you to sneaking alcohol out of your dad's drinks cabinet.
Yeah, but we all did that, didn't we?
Yes, but as I mentioned, by the time you were 15, you were pretty well getting drunk every day.
Yeah, so no, it was alone, so that's quite unusual. It was alone, neat, you know, I didn't start with your kind of creme de menthe with your friends that most people do. It was slogging it back after school on my own. So it was definitely like a soothing thing and almost like a bonding experience. I had this new friend.
The alcohol.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, now, you then, as you grew up, you actually went into probably about the worst industry for someone prone to substance abuse that you could imagine. Or the best, yes. You became a music journalist. Now, you write that you hitched your identity to drink and drugs and to men, and you became really quite tough, I think. As you say, you had everything to prove. What was all that sort of bravado about?
Yeah, bravado is the right word. I think a lot of people who get into substance use are actually really sensitive people who find the pressures of the world quite difficult, and overthinkers too. And I realised that perhaps I wasn't as tough as I would need to be, and so I started to construct this tougher persona. And alcohol and drugs helped with that,
so,
you know.
So drinking like one of the lads.
Exactly,
was part of that.
And people at school started to notice, and I'd get a bit of a reputation for being, well, the nickname was Junkie Jen, which was a bit silly. But, you know, already I got this reputation of, well, that's somebody who's going a bit hard, which I quite liked. And I thought, well, I must be on the right path here. And also I had this feeling that I'd been born onto the losing team. I felt that women, even looking at my own family, had things, they were on the back foot. I felt that it was better to be more like a man. I tried to sort of distance myself from women and be more manly and pursue those kind of interests. And to me, alcohol was something I associated with the winning team.
Well, fast forward years later, after you got sober and you did start sort of examining addiction and women, were you able to actually find much research specifically on female substance abuse?
Yeah, if you're looking at academic research, definitely. There's a bibliography on my website, and there's 300 studies that I've used for this book. The problem is it doesn't really seem to have infiltrated the services that we have. And also...
So academically, there are differences understood.
They're understood, but still the wealth of research is done around men because men are seen to be the norm. And often women are just seen to be kind of mini-men, and we'll just use the data from men and apply that to women because it's easier. And who wants to apply for funding just to study women? So although I did find these studies, you know, they're from across the globe, and I had to sort of pull them all together.
You're listening to Life Matters with Amanda Smith and Jenny Valentish, the author of Woman of Substances, where she delves into her own experience of decades of alcohol abuse. And it also explores the particular ways in which women are susceptible to self-destruction and the female experience of drug and alcohol dependency. Joining Jenny and me now is Annie Hine Moana. She's a senior lecturer in psychology and counselling at La Trobe University. She's also a clinical practitioner educator at a treatment service, ReGen. And Annie's familiar with the particular combination, I guess, of shame and self-loathing and sexual abuse that's present in so many cases of female addiction. Annie, there is a long history of pathologising, you know, mad, bad and sad women. Do women tend to self-medicate more than men?
Well, certainly that's been the conventional wisdom, and women report self-medicating a lot more than men do. But I think it's also worth asking ourselves the question, do women conceptualise their drug and alcohol use as self-medicating? Because men may not. Men may think differently about it because heavy AOD use is sanctioned amongst men, particularly in places like Australia and the UK.
AOD?
Oh, sorry, alcohol and other drugs.
Right.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
So I think it's how we think about mental health, it's how we think about alcohol and other drug use that's quite different. And the ways in which women experience it are quite gender specific.
Yeah, well, Jenny, you looked at a number of studies that show that girls, I think, start experimenting with alcohol and drugs earlier than boys. Mm. Is there among researchers an understanding of why?
Well, we could look at impulsivity there. We tend to think of teenage boys as being way more impulsive than teenage girls, but actually it expresses itself differently in girls. So whereas boys might sort of showboat more and act out and do the sort of things that make the papers, girls tend to do the quieter things, if you like, which is substance use, compulsive sex, well, not compulsive sex, but promiscuity perhaps, theft, fraud, that kind of thing. So they're sort of quieter behaviours and maybe a little bit more self-destructive.
Well, Annie, you know, this impulsive and compulsive behaviour around drinking with girls, in your view, is that inherent in gender or is it about how girls and boys are raised differently?
I think the problems that girls and women experience are to do with both sex, which is biological, and gender, which is how you're constructed. We construct our gender based on whatever available narratives we have around us. And how women drink, I think, is very much constructed. There's actually a lot more women drinking silently, quietly at home, as well as, you know, there's lots of women out there, you know, in pubs and so on, but there's a lot of women with serious problems with alcohol who are invisible.
So does that suggest then that women's drinking, and as I think Jenny was saying, tends to be more introverted, whereas men's drinking tends to be more extroverted, would be more social?
To generalise, yes. And you know, currently I've been researching.
And we're talking about excessive drinking. I'm not talking about, you know, just sort of moderate drinking.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. So in regard to excessive drinking, I think that's generally true, though women's drinking patterns have changed a lot in the last 10 years, which we all know. But leaving aside, I think the younger people who are drinking more socially, young women are drinking a lot more socially, a lot more heavily, and in ways that are that can be quite harmful. But apart from that, there's a massive problem with women drinking quietly, and because of the biological differences, they're doing themselves a lot more damage.
What I found actually was that a particularly vulnerable group is the baby group, baby boomer group. Mm-hmm. If the kids have just left home, suddenly
if the kids of baby boomers have just left home,
So
that's
suddenly
a sort of vulnerable time.
Yeah, because suddenly you might have a bit of a sense of purposelessness. You're suddenly left alone with perhaps a partner, and any cracks in that marriage might become more visible. You might be starting to get ousted from your job, so there's a bit of a loss of identity. So that's a particularly dangerous period for people to get more and more involved in drinking.
Well, Jenny, for you, you had a kind of breakthrough, I think, in your mid-30s when you grasped a distinction between impulse and instinct. What is that distinction for you, and how did being able to, you know, differentiate between the two help?
Yeah, sounds odd, but I felt that all my poor decisions in life had been instinctive. I thought that my instincts were telling me to do things. I realised, no, it's not instinct, it's impulse. You've got to make a distinction between the two. And so I thought, well, impulse is kind of what makes you run towards something, and instinct really should make you run away from it. So I just learned to sort of recognise an impulse for what it is, and not a sign from within that I should definitely be doing something.
Right.
So it's just pause.
Fascinating, yeah. And now, of course, I'd be interested in hearing if you think men and women who drink excessively do it for different reasons, and what your observation or experiences of this have been. You can post on Facebook. Now, Jenny, you also describe a kind of triumvirate of stress relief that women tend to turn to, and that's substance abuse, eating disorders, and self-harm. What's the relationship between those things?
They're all internalizing behaviors for stress, really. So they're all people report using these behaviors for different reasons. Sometimes it's a sense of self-loathing. Sometimes it's to feel that you're regaining control over your own body if you haven't had much autonomy in life. And sometimes it's to feel something. You know, if you can imagine harming yourself, it's if you've been feeling numb, you can actually feel now a point in your body at least. So these are all coping mechanisms for stress and perhaps trauma. And they're kind of interchangeable. If you manage to get one under control, another one might pop up in its place.
Annie, is that your experience?
Yes, it is. Often when women are dealing with one thing, they might get on top of it and something else will emerge. And I guess the theme that is emerging here from what Jenny's been saying and what she says in her book is that women's ways of dealing with stress and distress are often self-harming, and which is why women's problems with alcohol can be more invisible. And what we see in men is much more acting out perhaps towards others. That's more common.
So, Jenny, as far as treatment goes then, do medical approaches differ for men and women? I mean, do women need different treatment approaches?
I think what you've got to consider is far, far more men used to access treatment than women did. So if you've got any kind of system that's been in place for a number of decades, there may purport to be no gender bias, but it was designed for men, that cohort. So what I think is needed is gender sensitive treatment. It doesn't have to be segregated necessarily, but so, you know, services that take into account what kind of individual experiences somebody might have had, rather than a one size fits all treatment.
Did you get that, or did you feel the lack of it, even in retrospect?
I did a couple of things. I went to AA for 18 months, and I chose to go to women's groups, actually, which has a very different feel to the mixed groups, and I liked that. But in general, you know, if you read the literature of AA, it's absolutely aimed at the men, to the point that there's a chapter called Two Wives, you know, asking you to be sensitive to your man's problems. And then I also had an outpatient service, which was one-to-one with a counsellor. So we didn't really specifically talk about gender issues or trauma, but at least it being one-to-one, you could kind of take it in a way that you wanted it to go.
Mm. Annie, given that sort of complex relationship between mental health issues and substance abuse for women, what strategies are most effective when it comes to treatment?
Well, I think the most important thing is to use a trauma-informed lens, which involves standing. If you sort of visualise the relationship, it's standing alongside of the woman and walking with her. And because women frequently feel very disempowered anyway, and there's also really high levels of shame in women, often prior to the substance use. But there are many different approaches. I like narrative therapy, but the other approaches such as motivational interviewing, sometimes CBT.
What's motivational interviewing?
Motivational interviewing was developed in America, and it's actually looking at why the reasons a person gives for their substance use, and it's allowing the person to express those reasons of what they like about it before you look at what isn't liked about it. Mm. Because conventionally,
as Jenny said, alcohol was her friend.
That's right. And many people feel that that is their friend, because that's the sense of self-soothing. It's coming through those substances, and it's a reliable source of anesthesia. So I think a lot of women are seeking oblivion through it.
Jenny, having an addiction, I think, and you can tell me if this is right or wrong, but I think it kind of makes you pretty self-absorbed.
Yeah.
The same, I suspect, is true of recovery in a way, that you also have to be pretty self-absorbed. So on the other side of that, is it like you can kind of look around and think about other people as well as yourself? Is that a kind of liberation that you feel on the other side of addiction?
I actually developed a social conscience for the first time after I quit drinking. I wouldn't say that happened straight away. I was extremely self-absorbed still at first. If you immerse yourself in 12-step world, then you are encouraged to be constantly analysing the self. So you can still be quite distanced from your loved ones. But what's been found is that to really focus on volunteer work or reaching out to other people in general. For instance, if you go to AA, you'd have eventually a sponsee, you'd be a sponsor. So that idea of passing on what you've learnt and just giving your time is probably a new concept to a lot of people. And as we know, you know, it gives you a rush of feel-good hormones for a start, but it also gives you a sense of meaning and purpose.
Mm. Annie, a listener has texted in, Cynthia, and wants to know if you could elaborate on the physical damage that results from long-term heavy drinking. She describes herself as a long-term silent drinker.
There are a lot of changes in a woman's body who's been drinking for a long time. We have physically less of an enzyme called alcohol dehydrogenase in our gut, and because of that, our bodies don't deal with alcohol as well. So there can be effects on many organs. There's increased susceptibility to heart problems, cancers. You know, it's actually quite a very long list. And I don't want to frighten people, but the long-term use really does affect our health. And the research is coming out all the time to suggest that women should drink far less than was previously thought.
Jenny, are you feeling healthier?
Oh, yeah, much healthier. I mean, I remember for the first few months, I just felt absolutely exhausted. But yes, you bounce back. I don't think I've felt this fit and healthy since I was a kid. So, I mean, there is light at the end of a tunnel. We hear constant, every day there seems to be a new news story about what alcohol does to you now. But there is a light at the end of the tunnel.
Jenny Valentich is the author of Woman of Substances, A Journey into Addiction and Treatment. Really good to speak with you, Jenny.
Yeah,
Thank you
so much.
And Annie Hine Moana is a senior lecturer in psychology and counselling at La Trobe University. She's also senior clinical practitioner educator at the treatment service ReGen. Thanks so much to you too, Annie.
Thank you for having me.
And yes, if you think men and women become dependent on alcohol and other substances for different reasons, if you'd care to share your observations and experiences, there's the Life Matters Facebook page. To let you know too, there's a link to the Alcohol and Drug Foundation on the Life Matters website. And for crisis support, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. Amanda Smith with you.